91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. What's the image summoned when one thinks of international arms dealers? It's highly unlikely to include South Florida 20-somethings. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper, but the dealers were three Miami Beach punks. This hour, we rebroadcast the jaw-dropping story chronicled by investigative reporter Guy Lawson. His latest book is Arms and the Dudes, How Three Miami Beach Stoners Became the Most Unlikely Gunrunners in History. We're talking a $300 million contract procured from the U.S. Pentagon. Three potheads involved in the Middle East War. One was a ninth grade dropout, another used Craigslist to book massages, yet another was a small-time pot dealer. Stay tuned, Guy Lawson tells the story after the news.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today's program is quite a baffler. It's the true story of three Miami Beach guys who became unlikely international arms dealers. Craftiest of the three was a ninth grade dropout. Another used Craigslist to find massage patrons. A third dealt small-time pot parcels.
The three are subjects of a new book by award-winning investigative journalist Guy Lawson entitled Arms and the Dudes, How Three Stoners from Miami Beach Became the Most Unlikely Gunrunners in History. And Guy Lawson joins us now from somewhere on the road. Hi, Guy.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. So this story's so unreal. It's insane to the point of absurdity. It's a great read. It's hard to put down. And of course, it takes place right here, as is often the case with unusual things in Florida.
So, yes, indeed.
Yes. So let's begin with a look back at how this story first came out as a front page story in the New York Times in 2008 by Chris Chivers, if you would.
Yeah. There was a story that portrayed these kids in Miami Beach as sleazy fraudsters who sold faulty ammunition to the Afghan National Army. A little backstory on this is these three kids, these Miami Beach kids, had won a $300 million contract, incredibly, by bidding online for Pentagon contracts. And as they set out to fulfill it, they ran into all kinds of machinations, Albanian gangsters, Swiss gunrunners, Chinese munitions hidden in bunkers, and it was a crazy thing. And so I read the story and wondered if it was really, if there was more to it, and turned out there was an awful lot more to it.
Well, did you suspect from the outset that the New York Times had gotten it wrong, or was there just, you thought, much more to this story? What got you to, like, say,
I thought that there'd be a human piece of it, because the New York Times hadn't spoken to any of the young fellows, the dudes involved, and if one of them spoke to me, you know, usually you find people, there's two sides to a story. And what really gave me the aha moment was when I realized that none of the ammunition that the dudes had shipped was faulty, that it all worked. And that's a pretty significant factual difference. And then I began over time to realize more and more, and as I researched it, that in fact the Pentagon knew exactly what it was getting from these guys. And what the Pentagon had set out to do was to turn itself into a huge gun-running organization by using private contractors, much like you have with security arrangements and other kinds of things with government, when the government doesn't want to do it itself, like with the NSA. So you use private contractors to give you this plausible deniability. And that's the dudes, these three young guys, had no idea that they were caught up in a much larger game.
Well, one thinks of arms dealers such as Khashoggi, big-time cutthroat wealthy operators, not former yeshiva kids.
Yeah, well, hey, man, they were imitating, you know, especially the leader of the gang or the group, Ephraim Divaroli is his name. He was, you know, he had a version of himself that was bigger than life. He was, you know, ruthless, brash, unrelenting. It just worked 24/7 all the time to turn himself into a Khashoggi-like figure, a lord of war. You know, it was almost like it was a game on some level, but he was playing it at the highest stakes.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. You know what? I'd like to go back to 2007. And if you would, you know, I'd like to set the scene for how the dudes actually got involved in this. There were these no-bid procurement scandals with the likes of Blackwater and Halliburton. And that opened the arms and ammunition up to this public bidding on this website. Why did they, you said just now, because they wanted to have plausible deniability. But yeah. What else was it? Was it the scandal? Was it that they did want the, and why didn't they, short of, why didn't we supply the weapons ourselves? Why were they opening it up to this international arms dealers when we could have supplied them ourselves?
Well, there's a couple of things to say about it. The first thing is remember, both those wars were lost. So there's going to be a lot of bad decisions made along the way. Second thing is that if the United States government supplied American standard munitions or NATO munitions, the fear was it could be turned against them. And given the way things have turned out, that was not an unreasonable concern. But I think the most important factor here is that they wanted to do it on the cheap. And the Soviet bloc style ammunition and weapon systems that they provided both in Iraq and Afghanistan are a fraction of the cost. Donald Rumsfeld made a remark in his memoirs that it cost $105,000 at the time, $105,000 to train and equip an American soldier. It cost $5,000 to train and equip an Iraqi soldier and $500 to train and equip an Afghan soldier. So, you know, it's a paradox, really. Like, this billions of dollars were being squandered at the same time as they were doing it on the cheap. And, you know, that's the kind of recipe that leads to failure, of course.
Right.
But to sort of repeat again, the reason that these things went online where three young men in Miami Beach could bid on them was because the government didn't like the PR image it had, that it was earmarking it for huge corporations.
Right.
Yeah, well, there was that, but there's another thing, too, which is the United States, you know, had these bans on buying munitions from both Russia and China, which were the natural place to get this kind of weaponry. And so that really left only one place in the world, and that's the Balkans. And everyone in the arms dealing world knows the Balkans are filled with corruption and all kinds of political intrigue. And so there was an established system to arm allies through the State Department, but that takes a lot of time, and you have to check names against what's called a watch list, which is where all the names of known gunrunners that sell weapons to African warlords, for example, or drug cartels. And the Pentagon didn't want to have to check. They didn't want to have to do basic background stuff. And so they created their own legal system, and the people in peril, although they had no idea, were the dudes, not the Pentagon. It was they'd given themselves a legal exemption. So when the lights flicked on, you know, the only people sort of left holding the bag were these young kids in Miami Beach. And when you think about it, there's kind of a larger pattern to this. You know, the torture revelations, if you remember in Abu Ghraib, which was around this time, it was all blamed on the guards. And, you know, later, much later on, when the NSA's illegal surveillance systems, you know, is exposed as all Edward Snowden's fault, you know, there is a pattern of people who are defenseless or young taking the fall for these huge policy changes. So in this case, there were economic and legal and practical reasons to use private contractors, and I don't think anyone anticipated these kids would come along, but they probably should have, because if you think about millennials, they're such a different generation, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and as you point out, these three who met in the yeshiva had studied the Talmud.
Yeah.
so they were pretty familiar with the ins and outs and how to reason things and how to break things down.
Yeah, I mean, all these cross-references to different documents, the words loaded with meaning, the ability to sit for hours and concentrate on obscure concepts, and you know, they were very smart. I mean, that's another big surprise in contrast to the New York Times portrait of these young men, was that they were, you know, sleazy fools. And they were anything but. You know, they were very smart. I mean, ask yourself, could you win a $300 million contract at the age of 20, you know, and then go about fulfilling it through, you know, all the complications that they had, the international and and domestic complications. It's really quite a feat.
Well, I'm going to go over the guys. Just one thing I want to say, though, is when you say that they were mistakenly portrayed as sleazy, that kind of rubs me a little bit the wrong way, because they were greedy, they were reckless, they were unethical, they were immoral, they didn't care where the arms were really going.
I just meant to say only that characteristic. Yes, all of that, what you just said is true, of course.
Okay.
Well, this website where they had all these bids, the government did, the U.S. government, FedBizOps. Tell us about that. I went on it. It's still operating this morning.
You did? Because I didn't. It said can't find server.
Oh, well, really?
Well, it was renamed, but it said FedGov, but I put in FedBizOps, and I was able to get to see some contracts that were being offered.
Oh, I wasn't able to.
Not for guns, but for other things.
Right.
It's absolutely up and running. There's been some small reforms made, but essentially it's still, you know, government contracts are open to this kind of bidding. The procurement system has been refined somewhat in light of particularly this case. But, yeah, what it was a place where if you were qualified to bid, and it was relatively easy to get qualified, you could just try to source the price of something and then enter a bid. And so Ephraim Divaroli, who was the leader, as I say, realized that this was the biggest customer in the world. And so he didn't need to go try to find other customers for his business. He just needed to bid on Pentagon deals, and he really dreamt of being a gun runner or an arms dealer, and so this was the natural place for him to gravitate. And he brought his friends in and taught them the system and turned himself into a budding conglomerate, much to the real anger and vicious dislike of his competitors. He was really pretty notorious in the business because he had no overhead and he had no respect for authority, and so he was just beating people on price time and time again.
Do you think he was no respect for authority? I mean, here he was a yeshiva student, and they're taught to respect elders. They're taught to respect authority. How do you think this happened? Do you think it was all the smoking of the pot they were doing, that they were so fearless and disrespectful?
I think that what they were three kids who, in varying degrees, rejected the orthodox life. They were kids who became, you know, your pretty typical middle-class Miami Beach kids, I think. You know, they had some differences because they'd lived in such an isolated circumstance, in the broader society. But more or less, what really drove them, I think, was that they were hyper-intelligent and able to take risks. Yeah, and respect for authority, what I mean by that is that, you know, you might think it would be intimidating to do something like that, but they just didn't care. They were just ready to try to make a lot of money fast.
We're speaking with Guy Lawson. He's a New York Times bestselling author and award-winning investigative journalist, about his book, Arms and the Dudes, How Three Stoners from Miami Beach Became the Most Unlikely Gun Runners in History. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Guy Lawson. We're talking about his book, Arms and the Dudes, How Three Stoners from Miami Beach Became the Most Unlikely Gun Runners in History. Guy, could you give us a quick profile of the others also, David Packhouse and Alexei Podritsky?
Alex Podritsky. Was an aspiring musician, a licensed masseuse, and he was kind of lost. I mean, he questioned the religion, and he'd come to believe that he'd become an atheist. He just doubted the certitudes of the Torah. And so he was, you know, in his early 20s, doing a couple of classes at college in Miami and trying to find himself. And so when his friend came along and said, you can make millions of dollars at this, he was suggestible. So in a way, he was driven by, as he says himself, greed. The other kid involved, Alex Podritsky, was very different from his friends. He was politically active. He had a lot of energy towards trying to change society. He wanted to be an adventurer. He wanted to work in a war zone as a relief worker. He was a kid hoping to find adventure in life. And so when his buddies came to him and said, hey, will you go to Albania for us and, you know, oversee this huge contract that we're trying to fulfill by the 100 million rounds of AK-47 ammunition in Albania. He was excited at that chance. He was unemployed. You know, it was 2008, tough times economically, and this was an opportunity to have a great adventure. So they were three pretty different kids, but they were all buddies, and you know they hung out and smoked a very large amount of weed.
And I believe Ephraim also did cocaine, correct?
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, in the book he talks about and that and many other things. You know, I think he was definitely a guy who was, you know, moving too fast in life. You know, too much, everything was in excess. And so it was kind of, even his family could see that it was just a matter of time before he would crash and burn.
Did you ever talk to them? I just wondered, I mean, at the beginning, David Peckhouse was more, he had a sense of morality and he didn't want the arms to go to the wrong people and he could justify it and say, well, at least it's going to the war effort in Afghanistan. You know, they want to turn things around there. But then once the money got to him, he didn't care anymore either. Did you talk to any of them? You know, they had to have, you know, a sense of morals and goodness that's put forth in the Talmud they'd studied, and then how they reconciled that with their actions that were totally devoid of ethics?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I struggle with that question because there's something just inherently wrong about supplying weapons, of course. It just, I think it strikes most people's conscience as just wrong, but it's important to remember this was a legitimate business.
Right.
How they got caught up and it became illegitimate and ultimately they pled guilty to federal crimes, but it was a legitimate business. So I think David, initially at least, felt like, you know, the Afghan war.
Wait a minute. Did you move? We're losing you.
We're having a little bit of trouble with Guy Larson's connection.
Lost.
And we're going to have to call him back,
I guess.
Oh, okay.
Maybe we can take a short break and try and get him back on, okay?
Okay.
Okay. And we're back, and we do have Guy Larson back on the line with us. Guy, I've never been a soldier, but if I were one and someone told me I was going to be going into life-threatening situations with ammunition that was 50 years old, I'd say, no, no, no way. But actually, this ammunition they were selling passed with flying colors, the inspections.
Well, yeah, flying colors, it all worked. It was functional. And, you know, in the Afghan context, having something that works was better than having nothing. And one of the biggest ironies of this whole thing is that because of this case and because of the prosecution that these kids faced, the Afghans actually ran out of ammunition. So there's a whole bunch of different kinds of paradoxes to this, but one of them at least is that the ammunition functioned despite what the New York Times reported.
Right, and then what they showed on the front page wasn't, it was just a small, like a little teeny fraction of ammunition that was not good, that was rusted or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're talking millions of rounds.
Right.
Yeah, but it creates the impression, it's much like the New York Times ran photographs, mugshots of two of the kids on the front page. They only do that with fugitives or convicts. The kids hadn't been convicted of anything. They hadn't even been indicted. So there was just a way in which the tone of the article was very antagonistic, and for good reason in a lot of ways, but also for bad reasons, I came to believe.
What were the good reasons?
Well, you know, they were doing something that looked pretty bad. They were repackaging the ammunition. They were trying to fool people. They weren't, you know, innocents, and they were doing it for money. But it was the way, you know, as a reporter, I know that you can take an angle on a story and you can set up one way or the other. And in this case, I felt like it was very, I came to believe, I didn't initially believe this, but I came to believe that it wasn't representative of what I think is the full truth.
Well, tell us about the arms. I mean, and why the Albanians had these Chinese ammunition, not the arms, but the ammunition. And then the repackaging efforts in Costa Trebica. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because that was quite a thing, and then how they turned on him.
Yeah, so what happened was Albania was this strange orphan country in Eastern Europe that rejected the Soviet alliance with the Soviet Union, claiming that they weren't sufficiently communist. And so it allied itself with China in the 1950s and Chairman Mao. And so the Albanian government became China's sort of wedge into Europe, this Muslim, strange Muslim, tiny little country, and China gave them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars or rounds of all kinds of munitions. It's a major problem in Albania that there's just too much ammunition and weaponry in the country. So that's a historical reason. The reason why it came to be used in for Afghanistan was that it was the cheapest stuff around.
Right. And so they had to repackage everything, and that's where the deception came in.
Yeah, this Chinese munitions, they had to put in, to hide the fact that it was Chinese, they took it out of these cardboard boxes, or these wooden boxes that had been up in the mountains since the 1950s, and put them in cardboard boxes and shipped them to Kabul. And they were accepted and issued and used in war. But there was a deception there, and they definitely were doing something that was, that they knew was at least dubious and maybe illegal.
It's just kind of a funny part of this that after they won this contract, talk about these women that the dudes called grannies who were administering these contracts from FedViz ops in Rock Island, Illinois. And they were actually the liaison between the dudes in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah. So that, yeah, what you had is the government knew that they needed to get all this ammunition over to Afghanistan right away. But the problem is they had no bureaucratic system to do that. So the only existing process was to do it like they do with their own munitions through this Illinois fort, this civilian run process in Illinois. So these women were perfectly nice, sensible bureaucrats, but they had no idea how to run an Afghan contract and how to monitor things in Kabul to make sure that the good ammunition was being delivered. So they just improvised. And so when they met with the kids, they had no idea that one of them was 20 and the other was 22 or 23. It's kind of amazing that they didn't think that. But the attraction for them, the bonus for them, was that the dudes were so much cheaper than their competitors. So it made them look good that they were getting this contract in a sort of cheap and timely fashion. So, yeah, you had a lot of this kind of dysfunction where you had a disconnection between Kabul and Illinois. And in between were these, you know, soldiers and the dudes and all these people trying to frantically improvise in the middle of a losing war.
Besides this $300 million contract for ammunition for Afghanistan, what were some of the other, actually many, areas where they had their hands in also?
Yeah, these kids were sending helmets and boots and flashlights and laser sights and all kinds of things to Iraq. Iraq was, you know, they were hoovering up almost anything they could get from 2004 forward after a mission accomplished. You know, the idea that the war had been won became, like, tragically, self-evidently wrong. So these contracts initially were just posted on a bulletin board in Baghdad and eventually online. And that's where Ephraim Divaroli really cut his teeth and developed what they call past performance. In the government contracting process, you show that your ability to fulfill contracts by proving that you've done it in the past. And they really did have a pretty impressive record. You know, it was emphasized in the New York Times, it was also emphasized in the congressional investigation that followed that they had a record. They won something like 115, 120 contracts, and six or seven of them had problems. But that was very typical of how things were going. Remember, I can't emphasize it enough, both these wars were lost wars, so you don't typically have, like, a very orderly thing in the middle of a losing cause.
Okay, so tell us how they... Do we need to break? Okay, so tell us how they finally got into trouble.
Well, this guy, Kostur Trbica, you referred to, was an Albanian businessman who was doing the repacking for them, the nefarious repacking. They didn't tell him why they were doing it, and he grew suspicious. And then eventually, as will happen in Albania, gangsters came along and wanted the contract for themselves. These gangsters happened to be connected to the prime minister of Albania. And so Kostur Trbica, this businessman, decided he'd get revenge. And so he reached out through connections and was put in touch with the New York Times and with investigators, prosecutors in the United States. At the same time, a competitor of the dudes, a domestic competitor who was mad because they kept winning all these big contracts, started a whispering campaign, a false whispering campaign against them. So you had them in kind of like in this pincer move. You had these two powerful forces coming towards them. One was the New York Times, another was the federal government. And the kids were oblivious. They just really didn't know the nature of the game that they were playing or the stakes of what was happening. They thought they did, but they really didn't. So their naivete is really kind of where they began to get in trouble. But practically speaking, what happened is that they were going to embarrass hugely powerful forces in the Pentagon, and that was not going to be allowed to happen, not without them paying a price.
As the money began to roll in, how did the kids, how did their lifestyles change?
Well, what mostly happened is that they began to fight with each other, right? You know, the leader, Ephraim Diveroli, began to want to change everyone's deal because all of a sudden it went from, you know, a few thousand or a few hundred thousand dollars to millions of dollars at stake. So unfortunately for them, they began to bicker and fall out with each other. So that's Ephraim Diveroli, you know, he lived fairly large. You know, he liked his nightlife along the Miami Beach, and he had a nice car and all that stuff. But they never, the huge money kind of never really got there because the government came along during that time and prosecution happened.
All right. So tell us about the prosecution. What were they accused of, and what were they found guilty of, and what happened?
So they were accused of 72 counts of fraud. There were 72 plane loads of AK-47, repackaged AK-47 ammunition that went from Albania to Kabul. And so they diced that into 72 counts, and they were threatened with many, many, many years in prison. And it may come as a surprise to your listeners, but 98% of people indicted by the federal government plead guilty because it's essentially impossible to fight. There's limitless resources on one side, and it's very expensive. Federal defense lawyers are very, very expensive. So they pled guilty, and only one of them went to prison, or two of them, I should say. An older gentleman who was their financier, but the other two, Alex Podritsky and David Packhouse, were given house arrest. But Diveroli went to prison for 4 years for that, and then 2 years for another offense. But yeah, so they basically pled out because they had no choice, but they pled guilty, not thinking they were guilty, but thinking they had no choice.
What about the loss of life in the Albanian village of Gerdek? Mm. Is that how it's pronounced?
Gerdek, yeah.
Gerdek, and also, of course, it's probable that Trebeka was murdered.
Exactly. The book is being published today as it happens in Albania, and it's on the front page of a few Albanian newspapers because it really is a big deal in that country. What happened was that this Costa Trebeka, when he went to the New York Times and he went to the, you know, Congress and all these different places to try to get corruption investigated, you know, Albania is a Muslim country that's a very strong American ally. There's the embassy in Albania is, everyone in Albania knows it's the most important institution in the country, even more than the prime minister's office, because all Albanians want to please the United States. And at that time, in 2008, it was just on the verge of becoming a member of NATO. So you had this very strong political impetus to not rock the boat or embarrass Albania, especially in the embassy. There were also allegations have never been proven, but seem plausible to me, that there were American officials who were taking bribe money from Albanian gangsters to look the other way while these kinds of sleazy arms deals happened. None of this involved the kids in particular. It was like domestic corruption. And so two things came of that. One is, in order to sort of steal other parts of the stockpile, the same gangsters who AEY was dealing with were demilitarizing or taking apart large caliber ammunition, large rockets and things, and they were doing it in a negligent and haphazard way, the way gangsters would, and the thing blew up in the village of Gerdek, and 28 civilians died. And this was a huge problem, or, you know, as you might imagine, in Albania, and no one's ever been convicted of that except some minor guys. And this book, I think, is hopefully going to spark some serious investigation of that. Costa Trebeka took on these powerful forces, the prime minister and the defense minister and all these businessmen surrounding them, and he winds up dead in this incredibly mysterious circumstances. He's driving along the road in a field, and all of a sudden his car flips over and he's dead. And, you know, they bury him the next day with no autopsy, and that's that. So in Albania, it's a very tough country. I wound up talking to one of his relatives, who I won't name, and this relative was thinking about trying to get an investigation started, and they were warned off. And so the family has been led to, you know, the family understands that if anything, anybody comes asking about this, that there's going to be more trouble.
Wow. So you mean they can't even determine whoever killed him?
Absolutely not.
And they staged that accident with his Jeep or something, saying that he had an accident.
He'd been hunting.
Well, that is a strong implication of this fact, of the fact set. You know, there's a perfectly healthy 48-year-old man driving along in the middle of nowhere, and there's no signs of any mechanical any other reason for this car to, quote-unquote, flip over. The first to arrive on the scene were people attached to the Prime Minister's security forces. And this is in the middle of nowhere. It's just exceptionally odd. I've spoken to political activists in Albania, and there's a hope that there will be an investigation that this book might trigger it. I really hope that's true. I know that his relatives would like the truth to come out, but they're too afraid to do anything themselves.
You know what else occurs to me? I didn't think of this before, but I'm thinking now, and I don't know why I didn't think of this. When they canceled the dude's contract in Afghanistan and they ran out of ammunition, and they were left there with nothing, why did they not get other people to supply the arms? Why did they just let it go at that point and let it die out?
Well, what happened, they were frantically trying to, but in order to ship hazardous materials like ammunition and guns, you need to go through a lot of protocols. And the Pentagon was trying to short-circuit all those things with their own system, but you still need to get end-user certificates. You still need to go through background, some sort of forms of background check. It's time-consuming. So finding 100 million rounds of AK-47 takes a little while. And so you can't just turn to another supplier. Another irony here for your listeners is that there was a world shortage of AK-47 because of all of it had been poured into Iraq. So, you know, that's how losing compounds on itself, right? You have one losing war that's cheating out another losing war. And these circles start to, you know, turn into what looks like going down a toilet, you know, the eddy of water going down, I beg your pardon. But that's sort of that's what happened.
I don't know if you know this. I want to talk about the film, too. It's coming out in March. But did you know that David Packow's did his story on Snap Judgment recently?
I did, yeah. I participated in that.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you? What'd you do?
Yeah. I was, you know, I helped arrange it with the producers, and I think I got a producer credit or something. But, yeah, they'd approached us a while back, and me a while back, and, yeah, I facilitated that. I'm still in regular touch with David.
Was he your chief source?
My chief source was the documents. You know, it's one thing to hear from somebody about, you know, this or that, they had this or that happen, and it's great, and I hope the book really gives you a real sense of inside that voyage, but, you know, there's nothing that can beat research and primary documents. So that was my main source, but yeah, no, David and Alex, and to a lesser extent, Ephraim, and then the older gentleman, this story has everything, right? So it has to have the Mormon from Utah.
You're talking about Ralph Merrill.
Yeah, that's Ralph Merrill, who's still in prison. I mean, he's really the one who got the worst end of the stick in all this, because he effectively did nothing wrong except be in the middle of something that embarrassed powerful people.
He didn't plead guilty, right?
That's right. He had
so he got stuck with more time.
Well, he didn't plead guilty, and the way that these prosecutors work is if you don't do what they say, they're going to double down on you. And so here he was, a wealthy businessman who has been bankrupted. He's in prison, and he lost his family, his life savings, and for what? To what end? This is as political a prosecution as you're ever going to see. You know, at the end of when the kids pled guilty, the United States Attorney for the Southern District of Florida, the ATF people, and the all these senior officials in government claimed that this was a great win in the global war on terrorism. And the only thing that had really come about because of this prosecution is that the Afghans ran out of ammunition.
Right.
So it's just, to me, that was really amazing. These political actors, everybody was protecting themselves. As I say in the book, you know, the dudes weren't the only dudes. These powerful bureaucrats and politicians were taking a hit on the bong of power. You know, they were just stoned on their own power.
Right.
One thing I don't think we've touched on, Guy, is Heinrich Thome, the Swiss arms dealer, and how he fit.
Yeah.
Henri. Yeah.
Yeah. Henry, they called him. He's from the German side. But yeah, he's an amazing figure. He was like this sort of, you know, if you think what a real gunrunner is, that's him. He's connected to all these different governments and munitions companies all throughout the Balkans and Eastern Europe and Russia. He would just vanish and then appear. And so what happened was the kids were buying the ammunition from Tomet for 4 cents a round. This is the Afghan AK-47, 100 million rounds. And they were selling it to the United States government for 8 cents. So they were doubling their money. And they were doing pretty well out of that contract. But then Divaroli found out that Tomet was only paying 2 cents for it. So he wanted to get it for 2 cents instead of 4 cents to double his profits. But the thing that Divaroli didn't understand is, of course, the money that Tomet was getting for doing nothing, by the way, he never even went to Albania, just for being the broker, that was the money that was being used to pay the politicians and the gangsters. That was the kickback money. And so when he kicked back, when Divaroli, you know, kicked the hornet's nest, so to speak, you know, everybody got mad and agitated, and that's when, you know, Costa Tribica and all these other people got in such trouble. So, yeah, Tomet, I think, personifies perfectly the reality of this world, which is that things are never as they appear, and if something looks odd, it's because it certainly is odd.
Is he still operating and dealing arms? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, man. Google him up. He's running he's in Montenegro, and he's involved with a company that has done kind of a knockoff version of a small rifle and automatic handgun. Yeah, he's still in business as far as I know, and there's no sign that he's going to stop either. This stuff is still going on. I mean, I really need to emphasize that. This is about a story that took place in 2008, through that time, but this is still going on. You know, half of the guns that were shipped to Iraq were lost, and half of the guns that were shipped to Afghanistan were lost. So
where are they?
They're being used by ISIS and the Taliban. So when you turn on the news in the evening and you watch this terrible tragedy in Syria, you should know that those weapons were purchased with American taxpayer money.
We're going
to
take
a
break.
It's a huge scandal.
Yeah, well, how did they get lost? I mean, how do these things get lost?
I'll tell you. In short, there were no controls. There was nobody in charge. It was chaos. And that's why the joke of this case is that the worst fraud supposedly committed in Afghanistan was these three dudes selling, you know, ammunition that actually worked to the Afghans, when in fact, you know, you had the United States government was paying bribe money to the Taliban to allow its trucks to pass up through Pakistan, knowingly enriching the Taliban. This has all been researched. It's just no one's ever been held responsible. There's not any prosecutions that have come from this massive, disastrous collapse of corruption and failure. So, yeah, you know, it is ironic in the extreme that this case is somehow meant to personify what went wrong.
We're speaking with Guy Lawson. He's a New York Times bestselling author and an award-winning investigative journalist, talking about his book, Arms and the Dudes. We'll be right back.
And we're back with Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Guy Lawson. We're talking about his book, Arms and the Dudes, How Three Stoners from Miami Beach Became the Most Unlikely Gunrunners in History. Guy, Bonnie, and I were just talking during the break, and I said, I wonder if there's any chance that Divaroli is listening to our station here in Miami right now.
I hope so,
if he
man.
Is,
I hope
if
so.
He is, I'd like him to call in.
Yeah, that would. Let me ask you.
I've been trying to talk to him. I've been trying to reach him. I haven't been able to talk to him. He's out of prison.
He is out of prison. I don't know if you know this. I went on Wikipedia, and it said that after being released from prison, which was recent, right?
Yeah.
Diverolli has been sued in Florida state court by his cousin Joseph Wachtel for extortion. Do you have any information on that?
Well, I hadn't heard about that. I knew that he was suing the government. So I know that one of the things that is on Diverolli's mind and Ephraim's mind is that the government accepted this ammunition. It used this ammunition, and it continued to accept and use this ammunition. Then it refused to pay for it. So there's something like on the order of $10 million of ammunition that was accepted and used that they haven't paid for. So I believe he's pursuing that.
Oh.
But no, I mean, I'm sorry to hear that if that's the case, because he definitely is a fellow that he has, anyone who gets sort of around him in business, he's kind of like the Tasmanian devil or something. He's got a lot of, people who get in his vortex do so at their peril on some level.
Someone just rang in on our board. We're going to check it out.
Awesome. I'll see.
Something else. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say you were talking about the movie. I don't know if you want to talk about that as well.
Yeah, I do, because one of the questions I have about this movie is that why is it called a comedy? This isn't, I mean, it's funny. It's absurd in theater of the absurd, but it's not really funny.
Yeah, I've read the script, and the film people have really emphasized the relationship between David Packhouse and Ephraim Diverolli and how that devolves. And so it's a personal story, and in that sense, it's got some dark comic undertones to it. I think it's safe to say that Hollywood is not as interested in the political and legal dimensions as I am, to put it mildly. I think they want to make an entertaining movie, and I hope they do. But I don't think it's going to, explore the political, the geopolitical implications of procurement policy in the Pentagon. I know it's not going to.
And Jonah Hill, it looks like, is playing Ephraim, right?
Jonah Hill plays Ephraim. A young actor named Miles Teller plays David Packhouse. And then there is a cameo from a huge movie star, which I don't think I'm at liberty to say. But it has the makings of a really cool movie. They shot a lot of it in Miami, actually. They were there through the, I guess it was the spring, because the movie's already finished shooting. It's wrapped. I guess they're editing it now, and it will be released next spring.
Something
the
that was
book. Hey man, the book, you got to read the book first.
Yeah, right.
Something that was really surprising to me is that Diverolli's own mother told the sentencing judge that he should be jailed.
Yeah, and then a rabbi got up, who's this a rabbi in Miami Beach got up and said, Ephraim offered me $1 million if I could say something to get him out of keep him out of prison, and the rabbi said as well, he needs to go to prison. So yeah, he clearly is a guy who was moving at kind of heedlessly and without really pausing to think of his circumstances, and I hope that gets better for him, because he is an enormously talented and interesting and smart individual.
Well, definitely smart, and so he was in prison for 6 years.
Well, he got sentenced to six, four for this, and then he had another really pretty dumb charge related to weapons that got him another two. I think he wound up doing about 4 years.
Okay. What do you think is behind the Times article? What do you think was behind the Times article?
Well, so I think that the journalist in question is one of the most, I know, he's one of the most respected and knowledgeable defense reporters in the world, and I hold him in high regard, but I had take issue with his reporting, as he knows. We've discussed it. A couple of main things, I think. One is, how you see a story in the first minute or hour, very often it's hard to change your mind about that. And I think that this story was presented to him as, these are sleazy kids, and he was in the military, I believe he was a Marine, and he looked at the ammunition, the quality, and he decided it wasn't NATO standard without pausing to think, well, was it meant to be NATO standard? And what was really going on here? So one thing I think the perception, easy to have the perception early on, and it's also easy for me to go back, 3 years later and correct him. So I am sensitive to that. But I think he also, it's true, the New York Times is part of the establishment, and as much as there is skepticism about the instruments of government, they rely on access, they rely on relationships, they rely on, you know, in order to get bylines at forward posts and on board ships, the New York Times has to more or less play the game on some level, and I don't. And so I believe that my form of journalism is a pretty unusual, it's kind of, you know, there's a few people that do it, not a whole bunch, and there's not a whole bunch of places where you can do it. So in that sense, you know, I believe that the Times, I wish the Times would more often question authority. And in this case, it was a very good example of where this, the bigger truth lurking underneath the what seemed obvious really has profound, I think, implications for not just why the Afghan war was lost, but why it is that no one in power is ever held responsible for anything anymore. I mean, really ask yourself, two lost wars, who suffered? You know, what general's been demoted? It's really incredible, isn't it? You know, torture, surveillance. Name me one person who's been held responsible for anything.
So really, you know, you're talking about how our government is operating post 9/11, generally.
Exactly. I think that, there's always been, trouble holding power to account. But I believe it's just become rampant. And in fact, it's become a policy to not hold it to account. I mean, President Obama said as much, didn't he? I mean, when he was elected, he said, "You can't go back and look into these things." But that sends a terrible message. When you look at how the bureaucrats and the investigators and prosecutors acted in this case, you know, you begin to glimpse a government in which there's never any responsibility, even at the lower level. The people are only interested in protecting themselves. And I guess that's human nature, and I don't mean to be naive, but I would like to think that it's the job of journalists and it's the job of society to, you know, courts and the other institutions, other parts of government, to hold them responsible. I don't mean to be so despairing, but it is incredible that the only people to suffer out of this whole fiasco as it relates to Pentagon procurement are three dudes in from Miami Beach.
Well, and Ralph Merrill.
Well, yeah, exactly. And Ralph Merrill, even worse, you know, and he's sitting there in a federal prison in Nevada, I think he is, doing time for, you know, essentially nothing.
He's a Mormon, isn't he?
Yeah.
He is a Mormon, and, you know, and he is now one Mormon who's ticked off. You know, he's like a lifelong Republican guy, and he feels like he has seen another side of government that he never knew existed. So, yeah, I hope that your readers will, your listeners will understand that this is an entertaining story. It's not so dire, but at the root of it, there's some pretty serious journalism, I think.
Right. Well, no, it is a great read. Well, we have to go. I'm just wondering, is David Packow is giving massages again?
Yeah, you know, he started a company. That's the thing I say in the book, is that these three kids could easily have started, an internet company or invented a killer app. David has invented a device called the Beat Buddy, which is a drum instrument that you use with your foot to accompany the guitar. So it's basically a music company that's going really, really well. And so he's succeeding. Alex Podritsky hasn't had such a happy time. He's interested in political activism, and this being a federal, having a federal felony conviction has really made things not easy for him. And so I really feel like he's another person who's pretty much a collateral damage on this thing. But yeah, Diveroli's out, and Ralph Merrill will be getting out in the fall.
Well, so we have to get out of here. Guy Lawson is a New York Times bestselling author, award-winning investigative journalist, author of Arms and the Dudes, How Three Stoners from Miami Beach Became the Most Unlikely Gun Runners in History. Thanks so much, Guy.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. We hope you enjoyed the rebroadcast. Today's program originally aired on July 6th of last year. Topical Current's lead producer is Richard Ives. Technical director and online producer is Paul Leary. And associate producer is Polly Landis. As always, we have free audio archives for download at our website, WLRN.org.
And don't forget to visit the Topical Currents Facebook page for links and photos. Tomorrow's program begins with the inspiring young attorney, David Lee Windicher, who was a teen gang leader in North Miami. After 13 arrests, he really turned over a new leaf. He now has his own criminal defense law practice. We'll also learn more about the fabulous boating and beach bash for people with disabilities this Saturday in Boca Raton. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper, up next, here and now from NPR News.